Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
All right, listen, I was too young to go to Freaknik, the legendary Atlanta street party in the 80s and 90s, but I heard the stories. There's a new documentary about Freaknik, and today on the podcast, you'll hear how this street party changed culture and also why it was canceled. I'm Alamin Abdul Mahmoud. This is Commotion. Look, when you think about Atlanta in the 90s and all the things that Atlanta became famous for, you might think of one of the biggest annual spring break events of the time.
Every generation has a moment where they come just to have some fun.
Atlanta is the mecca for black people in America.
It has multiple historically black colleges.
In the 80s,
we said, let's plan a picnic during spring break.
Let's call it Freaknik.
I love that trailer because it makes it sound like Freaknik is actually Iron Man. But that is the trailer for a new documentary called Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told. And if you're a black kid coming of age in the 90s, listening to hip hop, listening to R&B, the Freaknik lore would have been inescapable because it was embedded in the music and in the vibe of that era. And joining me now to talk about this Atlanta 90s Freaknik era are Commotion regulars David Dennis Jr. and veteran Atlanta music journalist Sonia Murray. Sonia, David Dennis, welcome to the show. I'm happy that you guys are here. Thank you for being here. Let's get to Freaknik. Let's go. Are you guys ready?
Let's do it.
Very much so.
All right, let's do it. Sonia, I'm going to start with you. I was too young to make it to Freaknik. That's not, you know, I wanted to, but if I was there, if I would have been there at the time, can you just paint a picture for me of what I would have seen at a Freaknik event in the 90s?
What you would have seen, other than things that I can say here, a lot of people enjoying themselves. I guess you could say that in a sentence.
Yes.
A lot of people enjoying themselves, a lot of people afraid that live in Atlanta and that escaped the city. It seemed like a lot of people had taken over the city, the streets. You didn't know where Freaknik would pop up.
Yeah.
And Freaknik would be just like a traffic jam, basically, where people were out of their cars and having an incredibly photogenic time.
Yeah. I like the idea of a photogenic time as a way of describing this moment. David, can you give us just like a sense of how this thing started in the 80s and then ended up becoming the iconic event that it was in the 90s?
Yeah, so Freaknik was really birthed out of the HBCU culture in Atlanta. Atlanta has Morehouse, Spelman, Clark, Morris Brown. And so a contingent of those students from the D.C. area sort of had this idea of creating this week for black college students. Mm. And, you know, the Freaknik term has taken on sort of a different meaning. But what we learned in the documentary, that the idea that freak was something that was like a common sort of 70s phrase. You added freak to everything, the sort of same way you add trap to a bunch of stuff.
Sure.
Now. So it was picnic. And Freaknik. And so now we think of Freaknik as freakiness, but like then it was just like people having fun.
Yeah.
And it just took a life of its own once word spread across the country.
Sonia, you were covering Atlanta's rising black music scene around the same time in the 90s when Freaknik was just sort of building steam, kind of becoming this larger thing. When did Freaknik first get on your radar, would you say?
Well, I understand, and it started out as the documentary explains, and as you explained, David, with, you know, really innocently. It was just people who could not go home for spring break. So they had a gathering at Piedmont Park, which is really like blocks away from where I am right now.
Yeah.
But it got on my radar when it got on the city's radar, when the city stopped, basically. When you couldn't travel around, particularly around malls, around clubs or that kind of thing. And people really didn't understand what was going on because And, you know, spring breaks happen everywhere in Florida, as we know, but people weren't expecting it to happen in Atlanta and to that extent. And it didn't. And when it got to the point where people were coming to Atlanta for spring break instead of someplace next to water,
yeah,
that's when people really started to notice.
We are in this moment where Atlanta is the epicenter of hip hop, or one of the epicenters of hip hop. That's, I think people don't necessarily know, but like that was not always the case. Not only was it not always the case, it was obvious that he would become the case. So when we sort of like look at, you know, the place that Atlanta plays now in hip hop, and back in the days when like Criss Cross and TLC and Outkast were just starting to build a buzz, what role do you think Freaknik played in Atlanta's come up as a hip hop city?
Well, I mean, this was also the place where LaFace was. You know, we had Rowdy Records, Dallas Austin's label. We had So Def, and at that time, when you know, the college, it was a great place to find their audience for people that were coming outside the city, like Luke and so on. To promote right in front of their audience. So I think in a sense, Atlanta took advantage of it in terms of the club scenes and the artists here, but also artists outside of, I mean, from Death Row and so on, took advantage of being in a place where all of their audience was in one place at one time,
yeah,
ready to party and trying out records, just partying with them, whatever it may be.
Sure.
That's what it was. So it was a testing ground, but it was also having your audience in one place and taking full advantage of it.
Well,
does that make sense to you?
Oh, of course. But what I love about this doc is like during the doc, you hear from Luke from Two Live Crew, and he's got like this brand of like incredibly raunchy rap that is presented as like a major force in Freaknik's rise in the 90s. David, since the doc has been released, I've seen some online sentiments that see Luke and this sort of raunchy brand as one of the elements that were kind of responsible for Freaknik's eventual downfall, for why it ended up going away. How do you see that? How do you see that particular dynamic playing out?
Well, yeah, so the documentary does not do Luke any favors. He doesn't do himself many favors in here in terms of the way that they talk about how Luke came to Atlanta and made this raunchy music, made this music that was, you know, sexually driven and sort of, you know, used these sort of college kids the way that they are already like that and sort of amplified it.
Yeah.
And Luke, you know, took a lot of credit for that. However, you know, as we see that, you know, Freaknik sort of took a turn in terms of the way that women were treated and, mm-hmm. you know, it became something different. And I will defend Luke a little bit here and say this and say that whenever that this situation was always going to happen, whenever you have men and women around women and it's unregulated, men are going to do things like what they were doing in the documentary. They're going to prey on these women. They're going to fondle them. They're going to do things that objectify these women. It didn't necessarily need Luke to sort of be
to
the
make
catalyst
it worse,
for that.
Mean. Okay.
To make yeah. It, yeah, it didn't need him to do that. Of course, he did not help the situation, but if it wasn't going to be Luke, somebody else was going to be on that stage making that same kind of music and doing that same kind of stuff and having these women treated this way.
You know what? Sonia, you looked like you had thoughts on that. Can I just hold you for one moment because I want to play a clip from the documentary. It's footage of two young women talking about one of the reasons Freaknik was important to some young black women.
You know how some people have some inhibition, you know, that they just want to do something that they just know they can't do at home because they know people in their neighborhood, they know people at their schools, and their parents will somehow find out. I mean, you come out to another place and then it's like a whole bunch of people from other places who don't know you, and you kind of feel like, okay, well, maybe I can get away with this here, you know?
Sonia, when you hear that clip and hear that expression of, you know what, actually Freaknik was like a place for freedom, does that track for you?
I believe that, but that wasn't particular to Atlanta, and that wasn't particular to Freaknik, and that wasn't particular to the 90s. That happens right now in spring break in Florida.
Sure.
Difference being, again, the people that would be frank, the color of the people that, you know, it all happening in Atlanta and so on, and the music. There was an interplay of a lot of different elements, but what she's saying is not particular to the 90s or Freaknik. That happens when people go away from their home to someplace else to be something else. That goes to what happens in Vegas, you know, stays in Vegas.
Sure.
That's the way people act when they leave their home to go be or do something else.
I think what we heard there, David, is that like Freaknik was like this place for young black women to express themselves in a way that maybe their families or society would have frowned upon, but also in ways that had little to do with the male gaze, right? Like you could do any outdoor party of that scale, there are opportunities where, as you mentioned, you know, if there are bad actors, they are going to prey upon people. In the doc, we learned that there was at least 1 year of arrests for rape and fondling. We also meet one black woman who was almost raped herself. David, how did you feel about the way that the doc handled this aspect of Freaknik's legacy? Do you think it made it like Freaknik was a problem, or do you think it sort of zoomed out to a larger thing?
Yeah, I think they tried to walk this sort of tight rope, and Mark Lamont Hill in there is trying to weave something here also in the fact that they are highlighting a situation in which there are men objectifying women and violating women and doing, you know, things to these women.
Because yeah, it did happen.
While also, yeah. It did happen while yeah. also trying to make it see that this is not something that's exclusive to black culture and exclusive to black men. Because of the stereotypes that we have about what, you know, how we feel about black men are just, you know, just always just have a proclivity to not be able to control their sexual inhibitions and things like that. So the documentary tried to sort of try to, you know, thread that needle really precisely. What, you know, I could have seen there is the fact that these things happen whenever like men and women are together, like sexual violence, misogyny, objectification knows no color. Right. Like this stuff happens, you know, at these large concert venues, a documentary about, you know, the concert in the late '90s where this sort of stuff happened. This will happen anywhere in the country. And so it's not particular to Freaknik, but it is important to know that this is a huge, huge issue that was going on at the time.
Sonia, it's kind of become embedded into the narrative about why Freaknik went away, right? Like this idea is like this is at least like a part of Freaknik's downfall. What do you make of what David Dennis Jr. was just saying this there?
I concur. I mean, what made it go away is the city made it go away. They had no control over it before. I mean, sure, those elements and there was a criminal element and so on. But understand, there were people, obviously, and businesses that welcomed Freaknik, too.
Yeah.
I was a big money is big for the malls. It was big for the clubs. It was big for parties. It was a lot of that. But what shut it down was, you know, the year I think it was Bill Campbell, you know, decided that Mayor Bill Campbell that. You know, we're going to block off, we're going to stop the street party.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't like, you know, the people that participated stopped it. It was the city that stopped it. And once you couldn't have this rolling street party any longer, then people couldn't land or do whatever they were trying to do in the streets. And it just, it toned it down a great deal. And when once the city got involved inside it and decided that this was enough, that's when it ended.
I have to say that like there is every city wants to think of itself as like a fun city, a city that is willing to encourage young people to sort of explore and lower their inhibitions and come and enjoy themselves. Before we got into the studio, I was reading a piece in the New York Times about how this year, you know, in Miami's sort of trying to very actively say, we are not the city for spring break. Miami famously the city for spring break. Like that is, you know, that is sort of like what you maybe know Miami for. Every city eventually becomes the town in Footloose, the movie. Eventually they go like, you know what, young people, you're having way too much fun. Get out of here. And that feels to be like kind of embedded into the narrative of Freaknik. David, Freaknik eventually came to an end, but more recently the Freaknik name has been reclaimed maybe by younger generations of event promoters. This doc ends with some of the older generation kind of bemoaning the current reclamation of that name, you know, also being like, you know, we get it. We appreciate you guys are honoring the legacy of Freaknik. How are you choosing to remember the Freaknik, you know, 90s era right now?
Well, yeah, as somebody who also was too young to go to Freaknik, for me, being raised in Jackson, in Mississippi, it was two things. It was Freaknik and Bayou Classic. Like these were these things to go to, right?
Yeah.
And so as as every generation, when they want something as a child and they can't get it, when they get of age to get it, they want to have that thing. That's why people my age go around wearing Jordans that our parents wouldn't let us get when we were eight years
old. I'm doing it right now, 100%.
Right, yes. That's what we do, right? So we want to have Freaknik too. Our older siblings went to Freaknik. We want to have it too. We want to have but the problem is it's not going to be the same.
Yeah.
It's going to be sort of corporatized. It's going to not going to have that organic energy that the original Freaknik had.
Yeah.
But people just want to honor this thing and want to be part of this thing that we grew up loving and want to be a part of. And there is an understanding. I don't think anybody who's doing this is going to think that the original Freaknik is going to come back.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who watch the documentary know that a lot of the aspects of that Freaknik should not come back, right?
Sure.
But, you know, that's just what it's going to be. It's going to be something that honors that time. It's never going to be the same. But I think if 21 Savage wants to have a Freaknik party, let 21 Savage have a Freaknik party.
Sonia, 30 seconds to you. How are you choosing to remember the 90s Freaknik era?
I'm proud that, you know, what Jermaine says in the documentary talks about, you know, what that has brought, that people came to Atlanta because of Freaknik, good or bad, but they enjoy themselves. And Atlanta is the place that it is now in terms of Black culture and so on, truly because a lot of people first experienced it in that way. Mm-hmm. So I'm proud of in the end what it became, because it showed off Atlanta in a lot of different ways, not all of them good.
Yeah.
But I think it did show that a place where, generally speaking, Black people could come and enjoy themselves and maybe even live. And then clearly that has lived, that has gone on, and I'm proud of that.
That's a perfect place to leave it. Sonia, David, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you guys being here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Sonia Murray is a longtime music journalist and content manager at Georgia Public Broadcasting. David Dennis Jr. is a veteran music journalist and culture critic. He's also based in the ATL. By the way, that new doc, Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told, is streaming right now on Disney+.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Another flow. Every time I hear a brother pull a gun, trying to make a sister feel low, you know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring breath to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking. One day I was walking down a block. I had my cutoff shorts on, right? Because it was crazy hot. I walk past these dudes when they pass me.
That is a bit of Queen Latifah, UNITY, taking you back to 1995. My name is Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Look, fans of Eurovision would have had this marked on their calendar for a while, but Eurovision is coming back. It's coming back in May. And what makes Eurovision amazing is that it has this massive audience, right? Because it's basically like the Olympics of songs. Every country is represented by one song, and then the competition gets more than 160 million viewers every year. It's just wildly popular. The songs are supposed to be overdramatic. The performance is supposed to be a spectacle. But the songs have to remain apolitical. However, this year, this year's competition is already being talked about, and I'm going to tell you why. It's because Israel's submission has generated a lot of controversy. Israel submitted a song called October Rain, but then it got rejected because it was seen as too political for the competition. And then after several changes to the lyrics and a renaming to Hurricane, Israel's entry got accepted. But even as it got accepted, a debate is going on about its place in the competition, of course, amid the Israel-Hamas war. Here with me to talk about all of this is Karen Fricker, who I think, Karen, we can now reasonably say you are our Eurovision correspondent. How are you?
I'm great, and I'm proud to hold that title.
I'm grateful for you. Listen, let's talk about the controversy. Let's talk about this year's story, the controversy over Israel's song entry for this year's Eurovision. What's the story there?
Well, just for some background, Israel, kind of against expectations, because we don't think of Israel necessarily as a European country, it's been in Eurovision for a long time. It's been involved since 1973. It's competed 45 times. It's won 4 times. And there's a lot going on around Israel in Eurovision this year. There are debates about whether Israel should be allowed to compete at all in light of the current conflict. There's debates back and forth, and we'll talk about that. And then the song itself is there's been trouble around the song because the initial submission was disqualified by the organizers because they said it was too political.
Right. Well, I mean, okay. So at a certain point, it looked like they were going to drop out, but then the Israeli president intervened. How did that go?
Yeah, like amazing. So the first song, like you said, it was called October Rain, and the singer's called Eden Golan. And I'll read you some of the lyrics of that initial submission.
Okay.
writers of the history, stand with me. I'm still wet from this October rain. There's no air left to breathe. And then sung in Hebrew, they were all good children, each one of them. Mm. So this was interpreted as an overt reference to the Hamas attack on October 7th. And so the organizers said, we're not a political contest. You can't do that. So Israel said, the Israeli broadcaster said, okay, we're not going to play. But then the president, Isaac Herzog, said, no, I think we need to be involved at this point in our history. We need to take every opportunity to be on the global stage. Mm-hmm. So a bunch of stuff goes on. It is still the same melody, but now it is a new title and new lyrics, and the song is called Hurricane, and it has been accepted.
Okay, we have a bit of Hurricane, so I want to play a little bit of it so people can hear what it sounds like.
Baby, promise me you'll hold me again. I'm still broken from this hurricane. This hurricane.
So Eurovision is run by the Europe Broadcasting Union, and the EBU has rejected the demands for Israel to be removed because of the war in Gaza. What's been the general reaction to just having Israel in the competition at all?
It is really mixed and really fraught. In the Nordic countries and in Ireland in particular, there have been petitions signed by musicians and members of the public saying that it is not appropriate for Israel to be competing because of the war. By contrast, over 100 celebrities, including Helen Mirren, Liev Schreiber, Boy George, and Gene Simmons, all signed a petition saying Israel should compete, and that those who are saying that they shouldn't are the ones who are politicizing it. Right.
I see.
So back and forth claims.
Yeah.
There have been calls for other countries not to compete, saying if Israel competes, we shouldn't. But nobody has pulled out yet. So the 37 countries that were expected to perform are still expected to perform. I think this is the beginning of a story that's going to continue to roll out, and I think it's going to continue to be contentious up to and through the contest.
I was going to say, because the contest is in May, like we've got quite a bit of time for all of this to continue to unfold. We should say that Israel's cultural and sports minister, Miki Zohar, said that he hopes that the quote is, Eurovision will remain a musical and cultural event and not a political arena. This idea to remain quote-unquote neutral is one of the goals of Eurovision. How good is Eurovision actually, though, at keeping things apolitical, do you think?
It's impossible, and that's why I find it so fascinating, because it's a song contest, but it's a contest of nations, that you vote for Israel, you vote for Ukraine.
Right.
And as such, that's going to bring the context of what we think and feel about countries. So it's never been just about song, and that's why I think it continues to endure and why we're talking about it, because it becomes this kind of conduit for larger tensions. I mean, Ukraine won in 2022. And it's widely understood. I mean, we can never know why people vote, right?
Yeah.
But it was a landslide victory. And a lot of people understand, including me, that it was a solidarity vote after the whole-scale invasion by Russia.
Yeah.
Russia is banned from competing. And the EBU claims that that is to uphold the values of Eurovision.
Mm-hmm.
But values are political, too.
Of course.
So it's so complicated. But again, it's why it keeps me coming back year after year.
I mean, like, I'm more fascinated by this because it is trying to maintain a facade of being apolitical. And in that, people are sort of trying to jam the politics into that facade. That's what makes it such a great canvas. Do you think the public is expecting sort of a stance from artists here? Should we expect artists to have political messaging in their songs? Or is that not so much a part of this?
Well, by the rules, you can't. You could not, you know, get on a Eurovision stage and sing in favor of a political candidate.
Yeah.
So where the politics comes in, things can be slipped in through visual references or through allusions that may be legible or not in the lyrics.
Sure.
And it's also the politics comes in the voting. But I expect this year, because it is so fraught, if in fact this does happen, that Israel competes, I suspect there's going to be it's going to be a very kind of noisy contest, lots of security. And I expect that some artists are going to take the opportunity to make their feelings known about the conflict through something that happens on stage.
Karen, we literally have like 20 seconds left. I hear that you have a favorite. Who do you think has the best shot at winning all of this thing?
I am not alone in saying put your money on Croatia. The artist is called Baby Lasagna. The song is called Rim Tim Taggy Dim, which is not Croatian. It's nonsense words, but it's a really catchy song. So maybe you can play some of it for us?
That is exactly what we're going to do. But before we do that, I just want to say thank you for being here. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on, friend. Appreciate it.
Thank you. This was fun.
Of course. Karen Fricker is a theater critic for the Toronto Star and our Eurovision correspondent. By the way, the semifinals of Eurovision are May 7th and 9th. The grand finale is May 11th. And here in Canada, you can watch it on the Eurovision YouTube channel.
Hey, I'm a big boy now. I'm ready to leave. Ciao, mama, ciao. Hey, I'm a big boy now. I'm going away and I sold my cow. Before I leave, I must confess. I need a round of decompress. One more time for all the good times.
That is it. That is Baby Lasagna with Rim Tim Taggy Dim, courageous entry for Eurovision this year. And that is it for the podcast today. Remember, you can listen to the show anytime you like, wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Alamine Abdul Mahmoud. We got some Eurovision songs to listen to.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.